Hello and welcome to the Liminalist, the podcast between. This week I'm talking to Chedimir about the question of enlightenment and the forces of counter-enlightenment that seem to keep humanity deep in the trenches of unconsciousness. Get straight to it. I was just rereading your email. A question. Thinking about how I quite enjoy skepticism. I suppose having been a skeptic for my whole life, as well as very credulous. For me, there's a weird combination within my own psyche, is that I'm a very, very skeptical person, but I'm also a very, very gullible person, so I sort of need to be skeptical, or have needed to be. But one of the things I mentioned in the email that I've noticed recently is that, and Martin talked about this on the last affinity group, I think, about skepticism. But yeah, I've noticed around Dave anyway, how a certain kind of skepticism just seems to have fallen away, has become kind of obsolete, but it hasn't been replaced by blind faith or anything like that. It's just that I no longer have those questions. I have other questions. So, do you want to go back to the initial email? Do you think it would be a good idea to, I could just read it out, or you could, or do you want to just, I mean, do you remember more or less the meat of your...
Remember more or less, but we could use a reminder. I'm happy for you to read it if you like.
Okay. Let's do that then. If we assume that at least some of the many men who have claimed enlightenment throughout known history were indeed enlightened, we can surmise that they didn't succeed in helping others become enlightened because the overall situation has gone from intolerable to a lost cause over time and species, cultures, communities wide. If that is the case, then the efforts of the enlightened are not too dissimilar to someone being taken to the gallows while whistling a favourite tune, merrily accepting failure, hoping that at least one of the executioners will see through their mistaken action and not shoot for his own sake. Reminds me of an account in the Gospel about after Jesus was killed, some of the apostles were being tortured. I think it was Peter was one of them. And supposedly their faith in the face of torture was so profound that their torturers had a change of heart and accepted Christ, and I don't know if they let them go or not, but anyway, that's a tale in the Gospel. Just finishing the email. Also, it seems that quite a few people have been with Dave for a while. How did none become enlightened? Well, that's actually not confirmed. There are rumours that some have. He says that none of the disciplines he followed since early childhood helped or aided him ultimately achieving it. You see my conundrum. So there's two questions there anyway. So do you want to add anything, or does that, how do you feel about those questions currently?
I think that they pretty much represent what I'm unsure about. I mean, this is the first time I've heard that there are rumors of people who have met Dave or know Dave have achieved enlightenment. I hope it's true, but the skeptic in me would like to then meet them if possible, even if on Zoom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, they're not. They're not making themselves available to such things. And Dave himself is skeptical. He's skeptical of claims of enlightenment, including from people that claim that he's helped them to achieve it. He's never confirmed it. He feels that he's never confirmed it. Therefore, they're just rumors from his perspective, also. So I just wanted to, before, if we get into the meat of the questions themselves, before that, I wanted to kind of inquire what the questions mean to you, or what the skepticism, like, how do you experience the skepticism? Is it interfering with something for you, would you say?
Well, yeah, actually, I never really thought about it before. I just remembered last Sunday that I recalled Jay Krishnamurti saying, kind of on his deathbed, that no one got his message or his teachings. And I thought at the time when I read that, I thought it was a clever way of preventing anyone who had attended his classes, retreats, presentations, whatever, being able to claim enlightenment in his name and then abuse it. And I thought it was just a clever politicking. But then it just occurred to me, all these people throughout history, this is one of the, it's like the UFO conundrum. Don't need to go there, but if 1% are actual accounts of UFOs, then what does that say? So similarly with individuals claiming to be enlightened, if 1% of those claims are true, I'd expect like a knock-on effect, not necessarily an avalanche, but you'd expect other people around them. Some there'd be enlightened individuals would be multiplying rather than spuriously and showing up here and there in different times, different cultures, teaching around under an olive tree or on Zoom. It seems like a really, really inefficient way of getting the message across, and most people are not receiving it, obviously.
Well, there are two things going on here. Well, this is one that you're speculating is going on, which is that occasionally somebody actually does get enlightened, and at least some of the time, those individuals were already in tricky waters here, because Dave's saying that enlightenment isn't an individual thing. But anyway, just staying with that, occasionally some of those individuals do attempt to teach or show others the way to enlightenment. So that's one thing that may be going on. The other thing that's going on is the whole collective development of culture and the exponential increase of the population on the planet, right? So if it was only one of those things, it would be easier to look at your question, as in if the population had remained the same since the time of Jesus, it would be easier to gauge how effective it had been. But seeing as the population had been massively increasing and industrialization and all those things, there's a counter force, I guess, is what I'm getting at. If there's a force of enlightenment that lands in various individuals throughout history and then attempts to replicate, like a positive, a divine virus, there's also the force of counter enlightenment. So that's something to consider as well in this speculative question.
I suppose that I never assumed that it started with Jesus, because
Well, no.
things were pretty bad by the time Jesus historically appeared or didn't appear, whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
But it's I that it hadn't occurred to me. Just the population growth alone would counteract.
I mean, it would make it harder to see it if there was a growing number, but it was growing much more slowly than the population at large because of the exponential growth, if you see what I mean. Yeah, exponentially. Then there could be something occurring over thousands of years, but it gets harder and harder to see. Anyway, that's just to throw that out there initially.
can understand that someone who is, I'm imagining that if you became enlightened or you became aware enough, you'd want to share it. The truth, or the many truths. So preaching and sharing the good news or the bad news, whatever it may be, however one may perceive it, is almost like an obligation of the individual who perceives this truth to engage their fellow man and woman and share that there is a way out or a way in, whatever the case may be.
I think we have to question, if we're going to question this, we have to also question our ability to discern success, what effective results would look like. And, as opposed to, rather than assuming that it would just be a whole bunch of people getting enlightened and going around and making other people enlightened and this, massive exponential enlightenment curve that we would see, spreading across the earth like a James Cameron movie or what have you. It's pretty clear that that's not happening, but then would we expect it to happen in that way anyway? Aren't we talking about something that even in your own experiences is extremely subtle rather than right there, out there on the surface?
I suppose my question was really, it doesn't seem to be happening. It's almost as if the transmission doesn't go from the enlightened individual to anyone else.
But is that your experience, though?
That's, well, not from my personal experience, because I'm both gullible and very skeptical, as you opened. So I've been very, very, I commented on your blog once, I prefer my gurus dead, so they can't answer, they can't convince me of anything, But although I didn't expect it to exponentially grow like a, highly infectious virus, I don't know, from this perspective, perhaps there have been enlightened individuals who have passed it on.
And what I meant by, is it your experience? I meant is it your experience so far entering into the field, the Dave O'Shaughnessy field, which shouldn't be named the Dave O'Shaughnessy field, but I don't know how else to, identify it. But anyway, the field that you feel that you've entered into since knowing me and Dave, has your experience been that nothing is getting passed on?
Not enough is being passed on.
Not enough. Okay, so that is your direct personal experience. You're like, well, something here is good, it seems meaningful and true, and I'm going to keep investigating it, but why am I getting so little?
No, I'm actually fine with myself. I would like it to accelerate, but that's obviously down to me. It's nothing to do with anyone else. Well, it's not necessarily true, but the point being is... I suppose it really is... banal is there's not enough of us in general. It's not even a question of that, my particular experience of the transmission. It's just the fact there's not even enough people
to make a change. Yeah. Socially, you're talking about social change.
I'm imagining the change on every level of the individual changing and then naturally impacting their own environment. I'm not thinking people, so many people becoming enlightened that we overturn the state as it is and the status quo globally. I mean, for it to become more apparent that something is happening.
Right, but how else would it become apparent except socially?
Well, that's the way I agree. That's how it become apparent that it would have to happen within the individual.
And there'd have to be enough individuals for it to actually ripple out onto the surface of social interactions. So that's what I'm suggesting might be a question of the attention going in the wrong place to look for evidence of something. This is really, quite a deep question that arises, and there's certain things that I've investigated over the past that actually just yesterday I was thinking about bringing up again. So I'm wondering if we will get to bring them up. Sparked by my YouTube event yesterday, where I was so confused. I'm kind of confused by what's going on the planet now, in terms of there's this appearance of millions and even billions of people believing something and acting a certain way, but I don't see any evidence of it. I mean, I sort of do, but mostly in my own field of interaction, I see people who are skeptical, who are questioning, who aren't committed to flattening the curve and obeying the government. And yet the impression that's being created is the majority is going a certain way. So who and where is this majority? I only experience them through sort of third and fifth hand, through the mainstream media. Apparently there are billions of people out there. There's a pandemic, and there's a, you know, a kind of civil response to the pandemic, and you and I are these outliers questioning this, and potentially, you know, can we get thrown in jail for 3 years and so on, right? But my experience is we're in the majority. So I would say the same about this Enlightenment thing, that my experience is that of the people I know, the majority are changing and opening up. And that majority seems like a more significant portion of the species than this other unknown faithless majority, that in a certain sense I don't even know if they exist, and I mean that quite literally. Like, what we've got on the internet now shows us that it's possible to configure a reality, a fake reality, in such a way that there's all these non-player characters or bots or what have you that are replicating information and interacting because of some AI program, making us think that there's a consensus about something, but actually they're all artificially generated non-sentient programs. So now, without going all the way into full kind of Matrix warrior paranoia, do we really know, you know, what's going on when we're talking about collectively, except by looking at the people that we know and interact with?
I would have to say I agree with that very much. I hadn't considered it in the same way, you know, the response to COVID as in line with the Enlightenment processes. But then again, if I'm honest, I don't actually know that many people. I have a select group of friends. Some of them are share my line of questioning. Other people, almost surprisingly, almost blindly, believe what they're being told from sources of information and channels they wouldn't trust to tell them what the weather's like outside. They're blindly following these guidelines. So in my midst, I've got quite a divided group. But you are absolutely right. I mean, even if there were transmission sessions popping up all over the place, we wouldn't know. It certainly right. wouldn't be reported on. I mean, I found Dave, now that he exists, or at least I know he's about, I'm surprised that other people don't know about him. But the fact mm-hmm. is, I found him through you, and you through a friend. You know what I mean? It was very, very specific.
And if we posit some kind of genuine viral phenomenon by which the transmission is transmitting, the nature of the world and of society being what it is, it seems to stand to reason that it would do so as discreetly as possible. That even the members, I mean, it's like cell organizations, isn't it? Even even the participants or the experiencers of such a thing themselves might be kept in the dark about, you know, other participants, about how it's moving, where it's moving, where it's coming from, where it's going. Be a need to know basis, very much so. Seems that, I mean, just I'm not saying that we can assume that, I'm just saying that that would be a logical way for something like that to proceed in order for it not to get identified by the counter enlightenment forces.
Again, I agree with you. For some reason, I had this, I had a very different image when I posed this question on Sunday. I would be like, I thought we'd be out parading or something, you know?
Enlightenment pride.
Yeah. Parade. Like the Renaissance paintings of early Christians. But no, not quite. It would make more sense for everyone to be organized like the Camorra, you know, the sleeper cells, as opposed to being out in the open.
Yeah, well, look what happened to the early Christians. I mean, there is a thing, of course, about being martyrs, being willing to be martyred in order to spread the word. And, I mean, somebody came to visit me recently who just discovered me. Well, actually, he discovered me through the thrift store, very sort of fittingly, but he just saw my books and they were interesting, so then he found out about me online, and then he came through again and he came to visit me. Anyway, he said at a certain point, he said he can't understand why I haven't been killed. And I mean, he was kind of joking, but not entirely joking, and it was, the context was how he doesn't like to leave an online footprint or anything like that because of his awareness of, you know, the powers of social control. But, you know, my MO has been, well, I don't want to hide my light under a bushel. For one thing, that's an expression in the Bible. You don't hide your light under a bush or a tree or what have you. But just that, to proceed as if I was, as if I was backed by the good, by the light, and on the assumption that light is stronger than the darkness, and combined with, well, I can't really protect myself or my loved ones anyway from something this widespread and insidious and pernicious. So yeah, anyway, I've put myself right out there, and anyone who wants to can find out where I live, where I work, where my wife works, where my cat lives. You know, I'm just a complete open target for any kind of retribution. But that's me, you know. I don't necessarily recommend that. I'm not sure if that, what point I'm making there exactly, because in a certain sense I was making the opposite point, that we do need to be discreet, or that there is something about this that naturally keeps to the shadows, ironically. You see, I mean, I'm of course about speaking for Dave or repeating things that Dave has said, but when they're pretty much in agreement with my own perspectives and confirm them, then I feel more confident in doing that. And one of the things he's talked about over the years is that things are going to get a lot worse, and that in subsequent generations there may be no light left on the planet at all. Maybe just completely enveloped in darkness. I'm not using the language he's used now, but just my own. And that, so at the very least, what we want to do is leave enough breadcrumbs to keep the transmission alive, so that future generations or ourselves, if we reincarnate, can find some trace of the light still. And you know, those breadcrumbs will help guide us through the future generations, through when things really are just unremittingly dark. So that's the very opposite perspective from what you're saying that you're expecting. And like, if this thing is true, why isn't it just spreading itself lighter and lighter? Well, it could be, and this is the tradition in the Vedic or the Hindu system. In fact, I should conflate those two things, they're probably not the same, but anyway, in Hindu, about the yugas, the Kali Yuga, that we're in a cycle where things just get darker and darker and darker until they can't get any darker. And so the objective there is just to preserve some vestige of light so that something can actually emerge from that, rather like the chrysalis in the, the caterpillar and the chrysalis, you could say, some residue of awareness in the caterpillar. So there is a continuity between the complete destruction of the caterpillar and the birth of the butterfly. Something gets passed over in that shift, from the old heaven and earth to the new heaven and earth in the biblical terms. So like if everything is being crunched down to this incredibly dense point in order to pass through some evolutionary pinpoint, then it may very well appear like it does appear, really, which is like we're just whistling hallelujah on the way to the execution. But isn't that something incredible? And if you think about that metaphor, to be able to be whistling on your way to the execution is a victory in itself. Unless you're just pretending, of course, just trying to make a good show of it. But if you genuinely are light-hearted and you're about to be executed, then have you not conquered death? Because death was going to get you anyway. So it's only the mind terror of death that's the real enemy there. How you die, I mean, when you die, maybe doesn't make much difference so much as how you die.
Death is not really my big concern for me. I'm more concerned with life and how to live it. And then from, what leads me, but also the circumstances in the environment I live. So death is that's a given. I understand that my learned identity will disappear with it, but then it's not even constant during the day. And the body will, whatever happens to the body will happen to the body. It's really how to live. That's been my concern for God knows how long now. And that guiding light or that guiding energy or guidance, which I believe has led me on some occasions in life, where I wasn't looking for a result, I was just led by something, and whether the external circumstances worked out for me or not was secondary, because whatever led me to do these things were the right things to do. So I surmise, so it appears retrospectively. Yeah, but it's really the feeling of being vastly outnumbered, which again that doesn't concern me in terms of my own life. It's just that it's so deeply unfavorable that it carries a heavy weight as well. So it's one of those things. It's like, well, in that question I posed, the idea is that the carnal of something will be passed on to one of the executioners who will get it. But even so,
it wouldn't change the nature of the world.
No, not at all.
I see the doctor, can you help me with my mom? And he said, oh, your mom is out of tune. Tonight we party at the central corridor. The Pritzmen look for good, but God is at the dancing floor.
Then I'm walking by the sea and all the family like golden ships. From Metal Jacket, ring the bell, the scary monster sleeping in your bed.
Baby nurses taking fashion walkabout. The winner takes it all. Sings ABBA through the door. Ooh, mama, take your smile and have a drink tonight. The griffin does come in. Somebody clap my hand.
Occurs a lot in my not so much conversations but exchanges and comments and things like that, this notion that, and of course it's viral in the world, in society today, that we've got to make the world a better place, or the world needs to change. And I find myself continuously asking, well, what if the world is always the way it is? What if the world is simply configured the way it is, and that it never changes and it never can change? And that, I mean, Keats, the poet Keats, who came out recently because a participant on a recent day of event, I think one you were on, you know, the Easter ones, said how it was like it was written in water, everything Dave said. And I quoted that in my blog post. And anyway, that was on Keats's gravestone. He said, "Here lies one whose name is written in water." Anyway, he called the world the veil of soul making. He died at like 26 or something like that, of TB, I think it was. And that was his understanding. He had this very profound understanding at a very young age, partly, I think, probably because he knew he was going to die young, and that was so built into his energetic configuration. He just came for a short time, and so maybe he didn't lose the knowledge or the wisdom that he brought with him the way many of us do. Well, however it happened, doesn't matter, but his understanding anyway in those few years was that this world is a veil of soul making, by which he meant that the experiences here carve us into sentient beings. And imagine if you were a block of marble or a hunk of wood. We do chainsaw carving here. We people do chainsaw carving here in my town of Hope. It's very tacky, but there's a few nice ones. Imagine if you were that block of wood or that tree stump. It wouldn't be an easy experience being carved. Right? If one were identified with one's shape and didn't understand the nature of the process, it could just seem like a hellish process. And yes, at the end of it, you have, you know, Christ the resurrected. Like Christ had to go through that hellish experience, and without the world to subject him to that, then it wouldn't have been completed. This is where, I mean, this question's been coming up at the day of events, this emphasis on how something went wrong from day one in the Garden of Eden. I mean, there's no way to get around that perspective because things are so obviously wrong now, and yet there seems to be a purpose to the wrongness. It does seem to be a process. So then trying to get back to the Garden of Eden doesn't work. Trying to force the Kingdom of Heaven certainly doesn't work. So what does that leave, really? For me, it leaves a space for reevaluating my assumptions about what's going on here. And sure, one can understand that something is wrong and one can start to trace it back. But one can't really map it forward. Or at least unless one can, then one can't see, you know, the whole shape of the landscape that we're on. So, I mean, I just think, bring it back to you as the individual, like you're the one who's perceiving this. I'm still skeptical about gurus. I'm more skeptical than ever. I'm no longer skeptical about Dave because I don't have to put Dave in any context of other gurus or other spiritual teachers or even Dave's own teachings, because I've got my own life and my own body to refer to. And okay, so something is happening here that is enlightening, and on my time frame, you know, of my mental linear landscape, I could see Dave was a causal agent in that. He was a catalyst. So I could say, yes, Dave has helped me become more enlightened. I can say that without the slightest doubt, except about the language itself. I don't really know, was it Dave or was it light? You know, is he just a marker, like a hand on a clock that's showing me some greater force? Yes, I'm sure he is. But still something is getting passed on, and it's working. So I know that for myself. So I don't have, that's why I say certain skeptical questions I've had in the past have kind of dissolved in the end, because the evidence has accumulated in my own body. That's why I thought, I mean, you're an interesting person to talk to who's skeptical, because you've actually been more receptive than most people I've spoken to the transmission, doing the air quotes there, because I was the most skeptical about the transmission, in the sense of, why would we name something like that? Why would we talk about it? This is all just, you know, once you start trying to fix it into that kind of thing, then that actually reinforces skepticism, I think, because you're making it into some kind of linear logical thing, and then questions like you raise, they inevitably come up. Right?
Well, it's interesting because I wouldn't have obviously attended even the free event last year had I not been reading your work for 3 years prior to that. So when I finally decided to attend the free event, I actually just told myself, I was like, listen, trust yourself, you'll see through if it's a charade. You know enough now to tell if someone is faking enlightenment. And, you know, the usual, I prepared myself, I was just, listen, don't try and look for faults, just let it happen, see what it is. And I couldn't find, not that I couldn't find, I've completely forgot to even question, because he made so much sense. I was having the physical sensations that I've described before. At the end of the event, I was quite taken aback, but I didn't perceive him to be a guru at the end of the first event. And similarly, I've attended 4 in total now, and I wouldn't put him in that category as well. Something is happening, and my physical sensations through Zoom, for Christ's sake, are actual proof of this. It's just the question I did pose to you. It's, well, but you already covered it. What came to mind is, how come there's not more Daves to channel and more people to receive, so to speak? I can't put it any better than that. But then again, as you pointed out, we don't know. We simply don't know if there are more people. Because the world's pretty much been in a, almost, the technology has changed, but the hierarchical, social and political and economic orders have more or less replicated themselves. We're not living in anything new, except for the nuances of control and so on and so forth. But fundamentally, we're living in the Roman Empire or whatever, Greek polis, or we can pick any place, any time, or rather any empire from that particular time.
And what do you think about, what did you think about the three-day event with 100 people there, and is there something in there? Because that was a large number of people, and so it was a very, would you agree it was quite different, the energy there, to, because you went to a subsequent,
he seems to be, you know, in first gear.
So what do you make of that? I mean, is that relevant in what we're talking about, or can you see the relevance to what we're talking about here in terms of if there is somebody like Dave, or you know, to the extent that some of us are starting to connect to our life force and manifest it, what happens if we try to then bring it to large numbers of people?
I wouldn't know how to answer that. I find I was surprised after the first free event last year, and then you had the follow-up meeting. I think I said that the other day. I actually thought everyone had the same sensations as me. Right. That was the first thing that came to mind. So right. Now, obviously, having learned that it wasn't the case, when I saw there were, and by now I've learned how to use Zoom, because the first free event, I thought it was like six of us. Or nine of us. I had no idea there were like 70 odd people, which I noticed at the end. But because he was subdued somewhat, and I was quite frantic by the time I had a long day, wasn't even close to being ready for the meeting.
Talking about the first one now?
The second one. The latest one, the one from 3 weeks, 4 weeks ago. And yet, I got a lot from it. By the time I settled in, finished arguing with my mate about COVID-19, had to scroll a couple of memes just to calm myself down and so on, and still I got what I didn't expect, but what it didn't surprise me that finally I ended up breathing properly, my energy levels were finally going up my spine rather than zigzagging through my upper body. At the end of it, I felt, it's stupid to say, as I felt better than I felt before, but then again, I was less myself by the end of the event.
You were less yourself.
I had a pronounced sensation of my mind, like having a hold, like a tight grip on my bodily sensations, not allowing me to feel. And as long as the longer the Zoom event went on, the less I became aware of the mind, and the more I became aware of my bodily sensations, and the more pleasant it became.
So the less in your mind you were, so you were correlating yourself with your mind when you said the less yourself.
Yeah. I don't know if that's true, but that's just how I formulated it. I imagine it is, because I came in with all the thought process of the day, of the previous couple of weeks, tried to settle in, but my mind wouldn't stop. I couldn't focus on the event. I briefly took an interest, then dropped out completely. It was almost as if I was ready to perpetuate my uncomfortable state just in order to keep my mind available. But the stronger the physical sensations, the more I was like, well, I prefer this. And I can go back to being frantic in a couple of hours if I want to.
Right. But did you feel more yourself or less yourself by the, how were you actually experiencing yourself? Did it feel more like who you really were, or did it feel less like who you really were?
It's difficult. No, I'm not really sure who I am, but I am. I was less my predictable self in terms of my mental organization or disorganization, but I felt more in myself. From my posture, my seating, I took a, even the way I slept, my neck the following day, I was much more relaxed and I was able to process things more intuitively and less burdened. So when you say, it's difficult to say, well, my identity is clearly in my mind, but I wasn't referring to myself for the next couple of days. If that makes any sense, I think it does.
Yeah, I don't have too much trouble relating to your experience. I was just wondering where we're going now, what we're trying to get to, because I brought up the free event in terms of what happens to the enlightened life force, let's say, in an individual when it tries to distribute itself or share itself with many people, including many people who aren't really able to have the experience that you've had.
Well, you suggesting it dissipates somehow, because I just imagine that whatever life force they is, for lack of a better term, channeling, that it was inexhaustible. That was just my presumption.
Okay, so question your presumptions.
Right.
So do you mean that, because if you're talking about the enlightenment transmission as in the source of all existence, synonymous with God, then yeah, we could say that's infinite and inexhaustible. But if you're talking about one individual and their life force, then presumably you would presume that that isn't inexhaustible.
I concur.
Yeah?
Yeah, sure.
And that is what we're talking about. Is what your question is about. If there are individuals who get enlightened, how come they haven't gone around the world in enlightening everybody else? How come they haven't been successful? Well, this is what I'm trying to get to the answers, because if they encounter so much resistance everywhere they go, they're going to expend their life force in no time if they're not very discerning and discreet, and or they'll end up crucified. The only way Jesus could reach as many people as he did, and 2,000 years later we're still talking about the guy, is he got crucified.
To be fair, he was only really active for about 3 years.
Yeah, so he was pretty successful, I guess. And depending on how you gauge success, Christianity in the Vatican obviously is not a very good fruit, but in terms of the awareness that has transmitted, or the wisdom that has transmitted over 2,000 years, it's still alive. That's pretty effective. But anyway, my point was, there was a very heavy price for that in terms of his own life and those he loved. And so we could kind of see a spectrum there in terms of, how much is a somebody who becomes awakened, gets access to the life force, how are we going to describe this? How much are they willing to sacrifice, and how much is it going to be a worthwhile sacrifice? How realistic is it to try and spread enlightenment on a numerative basis? And even, this is quality versus quantity question in a way. It obviously is in terms of numbers, that's quantity versus quality, as in Dave can reach 100 people all at once, but can he reach those people as deeply as if he's only connecting to 10 people? Well, no. I didn't have a profound experience on Saturday for myself, I felt that I was holding space for a lot of other people so that they could have a slightly profound experience and maybe just enough to keep following that thread within themselves and maybe eventually, you know, move into a space such as you experienced on the very first free event. So that's the first thing. But the other thing is also in terms of quantity and quality, if Dave or whoever was just looking for people to get enlightened as the only proof, yeah, he could end up very discouraged. But that's the highest bar possible, isn't it? As opposed to very subtle recalibrations, modulations, opening, the fascia gradually dissolving, you know, cell by cell in the body, so that the life force is gradually redistributing itself cell by cell, or molecule by molecule, or even atom by atom throughout the whole body of the individuals that he encounters, which, as I say, you or I can testify to. I certainly can, but you have also, that our fascia is dissolving, our life force is redistributing, we're getting more access to it. So that's happening, and it's happening for others, and therefore stands to reason that it is happening collectively, just on a very small scale, like maybe in terms of humanity, maybe just, you know, the first tip of the little finger has just started to relax. We don't know, really. But even if it were just that, it's still significant. Especially if we consider that there's a lockdown that's proceeding, that's trying to shut down everything forever. So anything that reverses that is a major victory.
I suppose it just never occurred to me that the individual passing through the transmission, the one who's enlightened, the one who's channeling, however we want to phrase it, that they themselves as an individual have a limited resources, and that they do have their own energy and they can only reach so many people at once. If the people are even willing to receive it.
And only to the extent that people are. I mean, in the obvious sense that if they don't show up, they can't be reached. But even if they show up, but with too many defences and preconceptions and suspicions and all the rest of it, they're not going to receive it either. And that, as I've articulated on recent Zoom events, that seems to me that reduces the intensity of the transmission, because it's not coming through Dave, it's coming through all of the bodies that gather together there as like a refracting system. So if we can't reflect it back, then it doesn't get amplified.
Well, that's sorted then.
That sorted what? Your skepticism?
That first question sorted.
Yeah. As in why it's not happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Given that the system isn't antagonistic towards it happening at all. I mean, the conditions we're in anyway. And the fact that people have defenses against it, preconceptions, what have you. And then the fact that the power or the strength of the transmission depends on everyone on it being reflected among the church of believers, on the community are open to it, then it makes perfect sense. Especially if each one of us hosts a carnal of the human soul.
What was the last thing you said?
But especially if the idea is that we all individually host a part of the human soul in general, the human soul. Mm. If it's present as a shard in each and one of us, it needs others to be present and open for it to express itself.
I mean, certain questions and skepticisms and doubts that I've had in the past have ceased to seem real to me because I realized that they were products of my mind, which had a certain perspective on things, including or especially enlightenment, that was all centered around the idea, the illusory idea of an individual self or an identity self. And so those questions start to make less and less sense. And what replaces those skepticism isn't blind belief in an individual. It's a deepening awareness of that we are all interconnected. Well, I say all, but this is where one of the places I want to get to, maybe. But certainly we're part of this larger collective, and so whatever's happening isn't really localized in individuals in the way that we think it is. It's trying to move through a whole system. So then when we start to talk about enlightenment being passed on as if it was some gift that, you know, that gets wrapped up in a ribbon and then passed on and then opened by the next person, and then they like that, is not correct, because it's more like a limb that's waking up after being asleep. So But there's something I think there's another question for me anyway, which has to do with it also addresses this question of, what's going on? Why isn't it getting passed around? Why isn't it being distributed throughout the planet, throughout humanity? But not so much as in what's wrong with me or this or that teacher or this or that wisdom, but what's wrong with humanity? Like, what's going on with humanity? How is it? It seems to me that there are certain parts of what appears to be the body of humanity which aren't actually waking up. And so I start to suspect that they're prosthetic limbs or something. Well, actually, the life force can't go into them because they're not organic somehow. They're not actually part of humanity. That humanity, when I start to have a sense of it as this thing I'm part of, is not represented by society, the collective, the global village of society of these 7.5 billion individuals that we hear about. My sense is, or my question is, well, is that really humanity, or is humanity something else that's kind of hidden or buried in this larger thing? I don't know if that made much sense to end the way that you often end your sentences. Did that make sense? Well, I'm being very careful. I'm trying to be very careful about the way I'm talking about it, because I did used to believe this, and I used to talk about it, but I just tried to let go of those beliefs because they're potentially, they're very hard to verify. They can be elitist, they can be, counterproductive, they can create all kinds of divisions. But at the same time, it seems that they're kind of necessary, or there is a question that keeps coming back, which is, what is humanity? Where is it? Where are we? Are we do we know how to identify each other? Are we finding ways to find each other and connect, and is that giving rise to something that is a collective awakening but that will never extend to the whole of humanity if we believe that humanity is what we're told it is? Something like that. That we've been given so many false ideas about what things are, including this idea about humanity. We've been given this false version of humanity.
No, I just always assume that which, whatever it is that I am, that another, we're not talking about running 100 meters under 10 seconds. We're not talking about individuals. Certain individuals have particular talents and they excel above all others. But when something as simple as this, what we're discussing, the transmission, I would just assume naturally that it's accessible to all. But on the other hand, I wouldn't have been ready for it at any point in my life until about last year.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have been the prosthetic limb until 2019.
Well, possibly, unless we take it more literally. You might have felt like a prosthetic limb in the sense that you had no sensation there, but it turns out you wake up and you're not prosthetic. What I'm suggesting is there might be life forms out there that simply can't receive transmission.
That's why there's a danger of it being elitist, but it doesn't mean it can't be entertained as a question.
Right, exactly. And, I mean, well, I was going to say one thing, so I'll try and say that and remember the other thing, which is about working in a thrift store. But the reason I brought this up, well, I think one of the reasons that it's trying to get up and out talking to you, is that I felt as though part of your struggle and dilemma that you're expressing today has to do with the feeling of certain feelings, maybe compassion or maybe frustration or maybe both, for this alleged collective humanity and why they're not getting it.
Right, it's compassion and frustration.
Right, but some of your attention is going to this other humanity that isn't getting it, correct?
Correct. Yeah, I see where you're getting at now. Yeah.
Right. So that's something in you that I think is worth addressing, and that's why I'm trying to address it. The other thing I wanted to mention in this context, I think, is okay. So working in the thrift store, as I've said quite a few times recently, I'm constantly coming into interaction with people who, you could say, I've got nothing in common with, except that we're human beings, let's say, just to keep it really simple. So they're not people that I would try to talk to about Dave, or even necessarily, the global conspiracy, although some of those people come in. But, they're just other entities, they're other human bodies that I interact with. And some of them are so damaged that there's nothing we can really do for them, nothing I can do for them besides maybe giving them a blanket or a clean set of clothes. I don't give them money because they're drunks, and I think it's really wrong to give a drunk money. My wife actually does, and it really upsets me, makes me very angry that she does that. But so in a certain sense, her attitude is perhaps even more kind of hopeless than mine, because she figures, well, they're drunks, and really they'll never ever be anything but drunks, so they just might as well just help them medicate themselves, really. And I mean, that's not exactly her attitude. If this is a podcast, she'd probably object, but that's part of it. And the point I'm making here is that there really are, in my experience, human beings out there who are beyond saving. I don't mean by God. God can do anything, right?
Yeah, of course, we're talking about us.
For you or me or Dave. Like, Dave has a rule, you can't drink or do drugs or anything. He's very strict about people being cleared out and are sufficiently open for something to happen. So there's a lot of people walking around there who there's nothing we can do for them. That doesn't mean we don't have compassion for them, and it doesn't mean we just think of them as non-human or anything like that. But it does raise this question of what's happened to the majority of humanity, and how, and what is it? Like, I mean, what is the state of humanity at this point? What is the state of these bodies? Because, okay, so Dave has recently said that, talking about the breath, you were on the event, and it's in my blog post as well, I think the one before the last one, that because of trauma and these other factors, the life force, the energy of life only gets as far as our heads, and it doesn't really get into the rest of the body. And our bodies are all, contracted, this fascia, like bonsai trees, they're wrapped in wire mesh, so they're not able to actually grow in the way that they are supposed to grow, and so the life force isn't able to enter and distribute itself through the body. And he said, because of that, there are gaps in the body, and something else enters into those gaps. So, what I consider, what I wonder is, and he said specifically that, there are bodies walking around with no life force in them. Nothing is incarnated there. So he's implied by saying that something else has entered into those bodies. Now, as I say, we can get really paranoid here, and there's literature and there's different theories about what's going on here, but what it suggests to me anyway is that a large portion of the human race is possessed by something that's non-human. That's the indication. Now, what it is, maybe it's vegetable, maybe it's animal, maybe it's demonic, maybe it's ancestral fragments, don't know. But it seems to meet the evidence. you know, first of all, the evidence of all these walking wounded and the drunks. And actually, I have to say, many of these people I've got more affinity for than people, obviously, who are running the world and in Hollywood and successful people. So actually, there are people in far worse condition, in a certain sense, spiritually, than those drunks that I can only give a blanket to and wish them well, right? So I forgot where I was going with that. But, yeah, I forgot. I thought I was on my way to something else, but...
Well, I would just like to second everything that you've just said, with the exception of the gaps in the life force where something else enters. Now, I can only speculate. I really don't know. But what I've observed in myself and in others that I know closely, especially people who are dysfunctional, is that it's the identity, it's the idea of themselves, it's their projected personas and their life energy, and there's an abyss between the two. So they're constantly investing energy in maintaining the persona. And it's constantly draining them. And if they get social validation for their persona, then they're well, but it's a void that can't be filled.
So
they're not really bothering with anything that's palpable, real, that can be, you know, they're not connecting with others other than through projections of personas, which seem to communicate between them rather than the actual human beings present. So I'm not sure if that could qualify as anything to do with the gap in the arrested development that we all go through. But if you invest so heavily into anything, and people invest in their own personas daily, whether they're encountering others or on their own, then you can't possibly... It's clearly a limited supply if it's directed into that, maintaining an image. And if you're doing that, you don't have that much time doing anything else.
So, and where do these images come from is one question, because we've got bodies that are self-identified as people, and these identities, as you say, they're self-serving, and they recognize each other, and they reinforce each other, and they take over the space where the life force wants to go, and they replicate, you know, ways of behavior through mimesis, and they create the world that we live in. So what are they is the thing, like, because if they don't come from the body or from the life force itself, then where do they come from?
Feels like an inversion of the force, of the life force. It's like a loop, like a knot. Something breaking the channel, not allowing the life force to pass through. And then one replicates another, whether it's in another individual or just a multiplication process within the individual.
Right, so I think this is what Dave's been circling around for some time now, is this discordant note in the nervous system, in the blood, in the semen, that replicates itself like a virus, like this idea we have about a virus. Maybe it goes all the way back to that original discordant note, that because once it entered into the blood and into the semen, of course it was passed on, and it was also passed on through behaviours as well, as in, you know, a child is formed out of the blood and the semen and the eggs of the parents, but also environmentally by the behavior, and including the inner emotions and the reactions and responses of the mother and then the father. Mimetically, this thing is replicating this original discordant note. You could say like a knot that just keeps, we keep tying a knot, and the string, it gets bigger and bigger. No, it's the same knot, really, but it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So it takes over more and more bodies. So, and then there's this other model that Dave has introduced recently, which I also had an understanding of in the past, which is what happens at conception, the energy of the male, how the male draws the energy down into his body through the penis and then puts it into the woman, and then it goes up the woman and then comes out the crown of the woman's head, and this creates this opening or this vortex for the child to come in. Well, that vortex, that opening, determines what can come in. So if you have a degradation of the sex act, so there's less and less true energy and life force involved, that opening gets smaller and smaller, there's less and less life force that can come in, but the bodies are still being created. So then you would have a replication of these bodies in the image of the distortion rather than the image of the divine, that have less and less life force in them, therefore become receptacles for all of the generational trauma that has been unprocessed from previous generation, whatever it is. I mean, this is where my understanding breaks down, because it is like a program that becomes semi-sentient.
I mean, this with the exception of the actual conjugal act and what comes down through the vortex, everything else I've observed personally of genetics and mimicry, and to an extent the ancestral conditioning is present. It's obvious if you just look a few generations within one's family. And he can take on subtler levels of conditioning. I know this is, it's almost impossible to avoid using this kind of terminology, but it's a kind of a corruption. The only question is, I'm not even sure how relevant it is for our daily lives, but you know, what is the original corruption, you know, where it came from? Because if it's replicating itself, what's the source?
Yeah, well, I don't know how. I mean, there's two things there. One is, trying to trace it back and map it back. At a certain point, obviously, you go from history into myth, and then you're, okay, well, am I going to become a Christian now and just say, oh, well, that's, you know, for God to understand, or believe literally in Adam and Eve and a serpent? Tricky, right? But one has to admit defeat at a certain point. But the other thing is, how relevant is it in terms of interacting with other people? Like, I don't look at the people in the thrift store and think, is that just an empty vessel for some ancestral fragment? I don't turn this into a kind of, into a value system whereby I'm judging other human beings, because I don't. But I can see why that would be a really bad idea to do that. But also, I'm glad that I'm not actually having to inhibit myself from doing that, because it's just, the life force doesn't do that. The life force knows when it's in the presence of another life force, and when it isn't, and it responds accordingly. And I could analyze after the fact, but that's not really necessary. I mean, there are certain individuals, I think, my God, if anybody's demonic, it's that guy. And I'm not saying I don't have any kind of, you know, I do. But it's not really, it's not something I want to turn into some sort of, basis for any kind of practice. But at the same time, if we're contorting ourselves mentally and even physically in ways that are unnatural to try and embrace all of humanity, because we're not willing to look at the possibility that what we consider all of humanity has this very widely distributed non-human or anti-human force or intelligence in it, then we're going to get all tangled up by trying to connect to and embrace all beings everywhere in a way that's impractical, let's say, because one can do it. It's not that one wants to do it in a theoretical way, but one can do it in a subtle way, as in embrace all of existence. I'm all about embracing Satan himself, if he would let me. Obviously, that would be very dangerous, but, you know, the principle is there, embrace Satan, and it will be like hot coals on his head kind of thing. But that doesn't mean literally I'm going to, you know, stick my finger up Satan's asshole or let him stick his up mine. kind of thing, right? There are levels of engagement there. And so when it comes to, you know, how we engage in life with other human beings, a sort of instinctive, intuitive discernment that allows us to recognize, without it becoming some sort of philosophy, that there's only a few individuals out there who are really real, who are capable of becoming real, and that's our focus, to connect to those, because we don't really know. I mean, if there is a salvation for all of humanity or all these bodies, which I think is really unlikely, but anyway, for the body, I mean, David's already said there is no physical salvation. So, but I mean, this is where things get conflated again. We're trying to save the world, no, we're trying to save souls. So, but to save a soul, a person has to have a soul. And as on the internet, there are non-sentient algorithms out there pretending to be real. If we get sucked into interaction with that, our life force just getting sucked into the AI, you know, harvesting thing, and nobody benefits from that. So so one can apply that to human beings too, in a certain sense. There are energy vampires, emotional vampires. There are individuals that we know, if we just give them our attention, they'll just suck us dry, right? And nobody will benefit, including them, because they'll just get further stuck in their own, you know, patterns.
Yeah, it's a trap to try, though. It's interesting how you can forget these things. Like, these should be the ABCs. When you start to imagine humanity, and when you start, God forbid, start imagining yourself to be truly empathetic, you end up just facilitating someone else's behavior, which then traumatizes you, but it doesn't help them either. It's not like they got out their same system. They're just repeating their own trodden path.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just bizarre, the idea is that you can't save yourself, and I'm not even sure if it's worth saving yourself alone. You need to engage others, but then you have to be selective about the process. And interestingly, again, if done intuitively, you can have lifelong friendships. But if you try and force something, it will invariably cost you. If anything, it will cost you wasted time and energy. And I'm not saying you shouldn't invest in people, you shouldn't give yourself over to someone. But being discerning, maybe because I'm turning 43 this year, so I'm suddenly realize I don't have the time to have the patience with everyone. A lot of people are just happy as they are. I mean, they might be miserable, don't get me wrong, but they're happy to be who they are with all the attendant misery.
Well, yeah, they're stuck in that, and the misery is what keeps them satisfied, so to speak, keeps them fully identified with being miserable people. And I'm not saying I haven't been that, I still am like that to some extent. So empathy, it's not a form of action, let's say. Like, empathy begins with feeling what another is feeling, and maybe you act on it, maybe you don't, but certainly it doesn't require action to have empathy, and empathy itself can be create great relief for somebody if they really experience that they've been seen, that their pain has been felt by another. They will start to feel their pain more deeply then, and something might change and shift. But that in itself is hard enough, never mind trying to save them from their pain. And the other thing that occurred to me while you're speaking is, how much are we doing for our very close loved ones who we perhaps can save in some way, that we can afford to worry about 8 billion individuals, or even, you know, people on the periphery of our lives who may, you know, maybe we think we could have a positive influence on, and so on and so forth. Again, you know, how much of our energy and our attention and our focus is being not distributed, but what's the word for that? Well, anyway, spread thin like butter, diffused, because of this social mandate, you know, to virtue signal, to be a good person, to be sympathetic, to be empathetic, to see everyone as equal, to whatever, you know, all of these different values we've been indoctrinated with. When we are actually tribal creatures, it is natural, instinctive to take care of our own first. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, although it can lead to feudalism, and of course it can go ugly. But yeah, how much do I do to really give my attention and nurture to my wife? Never mind, you know, all those people out there, my sister, my niece, now you. You know, there's a bunch of people that I mean, there's a lot, there's an awful lot of people. And I'm definitely not giving my all to those people. Even the people who I really can have a positive effect on, it takes a lot of courage to show up, right? So I think, and this is back to the, you know, the opening question, somebody who becomes enlightened, becomes aware of a responsibility to help others. Sure, I mean, they're enlightened, they wouldn't just go home and talk to their wife and their cat and their mum and dad. They would have a, you know, much wider viewpoint, but presumably at the same time they would want to have tangible effects and not just diffuse everything around, you know, everybody they encountered indiscriminately with some vague ideological hope to awaken the planet or awaken humanity. Because, I mean, that doesn't seem like that would be the enlightened perspective anyway, would it? It seems like the enlightened perspective would be what's right in front of me right now that I can give my attention to.
And maximize effect as well, presumably. Rather than chuck a bit of enlightenment here and a bit of enlightenment there, and then the person just walks off feeling good about themselves for a couple of days and then continuing on their merry way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, this gets to the core of what I've become more and more aware of with Dave, and what I'm trying to communicate more effectively now through the blog post. That's very my experience, my interaction with Dave is about me. It's really about me, not in some narcissistic sense, but when Dave's with me or when I'm in his field, the portion of that enlightened transmission is going to me in order to awaken my true potential, my true nature. And it's very customized, it's very specific, and it's, well, I don't know what word, when strategic is coming to mind, but it doesn't seem to me that Dave is interested. I mean, we've talked about this on retreats, like having 7,000 people gathering together and all this, but it's been a theory, and it hasn't really been proven by the practice. It's been an idea that hasn't taken root as yet, and maybe never will, because what's happening in my experience with Dave and the others is we're getting tighter as a unit. And yeah, that does mean that as you know, that amplifies the signal and that does reach more people. But it's more about certain souls or certain bodies or packages of the life force or fragments of the collective who are finding each other and are they're coordinating and they're, I'm not finding the language here. Interesting how my mind's just stopped working there. So, but something's coming into form through those individual packages of the life force that are finding each other and is being intensified, and it's not necessarily getting bigger, but it's getting deeper. So it doesn't seem to me that Dave was just looking for people and he happened to find me. Dave was looking for me. Dave was looking for you. Dave was looking for Martin. Dave was looking for Mark. Dave was looking for specific soul packages that were part of an invisible, team, let's say. I'm going to get too much like a Saturday morning cartoon here, right? But I only bring it up. I don't want to disclose these secrets. I mean, this is a podcast, and not that this is secret stuff, but I mean, it's obviously sensitive stuff. But I only bring it up because that's kind of the inversion of the tradition or the conventional guru, spiritual teacher model, which is just, I'll take anyone. And if you can get it, then you're part of my flock kind of thing. Right, Dave does have this kind of open door policy, but it's not really, right? You see, I mean, you've actually got to get certain things and you've got to be able to give certain things, and there's a self-selective process going on there which has to do with resonance, and only those life forces that resonate make it in, and then the resonance increases and something's being uncovered, I think, that was pre-existingness. So, I mean, you're here because you're already part of something, and becoming more conscious of something you're part of, which is leading to, I suggest, to discover the truth about who you are, which is you are part of something that it would be premature to just call humanity, but we don't have this in-between thing. Except if we start talking about the Avengers or something like that. Right? Which either gets cheesy and silly, or it gets elitist and dark, or there isn't really any good framework for that thing.
I think both ends of the spectrum work there. Elitist and dark and comedic. They work well. It's interesting how this whole thing came about with me asking this question about basically why are more people waking up and why aren't there more gurus, for lack of a better term, spreading this? And now Now I'm thinking, I'm surprised that anyone is even trying. It requires concerted effort and energy. Plus, some people don't care, and others are not willing to receive.
And there's a lot. I mean, there are a lot of gurus out there. As you said, Dave doesn't fit the requirements of a guru anyway. But there are a lot of spiritual teachers out there, and you know, not all of them are fake. There's definitely, as far as I know, none like Dave. But as you point out, we wouldn't necessarily know about Dave because, you know, most people don't know about Dave. So there may be others that are more like Dave that we don't know about. But anyway, the ones I do know about are not like Dave. Maybe that's why I know about them. And they're more, yeah, they just have larger followings, and it's more passive and less interactive, and it's not, I don't see it's really comparable. And I'd say it is a different level. It's more of a passive kind of level, people who want to sit and receive wisdom. And I'm not saying it's not doing them good and that they're not nearing some sort of awakening in themselves. Maybe they are, but it's not my thing, and it's clearly not, well, the people who come to Dave, it's not their thing either. Well, yeah, I don't know how to finish that thought. I mean, I think it relates to the skepticism that you're right to be skeptical. Insofar as your skepticism is going to help you to see that what's happening with you now in relation to me or in relation to Dave isn't the thing that you're skeptical about. If you see what I mean by that. Like, your skepticism can serve you to compare and observe and see, well, this is the thing I'm skeptical about. Is this what I'm getting into? And it isn't really a spiritual scene, like what we're into now, not really. It's much, I would say it's actually quite a bit more compatible with the thing I've been doing than the spiritual scene. But I suppose I would feel that way, especially talking to you. But as in what's the solution, or what's the answer to recognizing and realizing that we've somehow were born into a systematically maintained and sustained hell world? How do you proceed from that? What's the procedure when everything's been co-opted? What would it look like? It would look like this weird amalgam of spiritual group, with a cult, with, you know, the Matrix, with the Avengers, with some terrorist cell, with a Talking Heads song, Life During Wartime. And it just, you know, doesn't really look like anything that we've seen before. Or maybe it's that part of your dilemma that you can't convey it to people that you know.
I haven't really tried. I share with a couple of close friends, and I've shared with my wife. I haven't felt the need to share because I have nothing to report to anyone who hasn't experienced it. If you see what I mean? I couldn't give them a piece of wisdom now that I've picked up. I'm describing my physical sensations and my insights, I don't think would be sufficient enough, given that I would say it out of the blue to friends without any reference or context. But so, something from what you just said a moment ago made me remember one of your blog posts from a while ago, which is that, I'm paraphrasing obviously, but it's being in a tunnel and mapping the tunnel so thoroughly well that you forgot to look for the light. something along those lines.
Yeah.
And that made an impression on me, because I realized that I basically stopped looking for the light. I forgot about the light completely. I just thought, the better I know the tunnel, you know, it would kind of, I was hoping that it would disintegrate. There would be no spoon, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
The tunnel is just infinite, or so it seems to be. And I really don't have the time to keep inspecting it. I kind of know what's going on relatively well. I could argue my case relatively well, and I could dismantle official narratives quite convincingly. And where does that leave me? Well, here, obviously.
Mm-hmm. So is that a bit of a conundrum? Because here looks like, I mean, this has been a conundrum for me, is that the here that Mapping Hell has got me to, which is, as I said yesterday on YouTube, I see the light. I'm still in the tunnel, but I do see the light. So I can just keep moving forward. I don't need to map the tunnel anymore, even though I need to keep an eye out for obstacles because it's still quite dark, right? But if I try and describe the light, there's a danger, well, I'm not in it yet, so I'll get it wrong, but there's also the danger that it will be unconvincing to those who are still focused on the tunnel. If it ends up just sounding like the spiritual solution, the solution of spirituality, which is part of the tunnel, right? And we know there are these fake solutions. And the reason they're effective is that they very closely resemble the thing that they've counterfeited. So, I mean, is there a concern? Do you have a concern about that? As in, how do you convey this? And it might sound just like I've just become a spiritual person. And or do you have a concern that you yourself could be falling into a trap?
Curiously, neither. I've always been on some kind of spiritual quest, but it just didn't look like this. And now this seems more genuine than the quest I was on. And I certainly wasn't on your blog because of my spiritual quest. I was there for the nuts and bolts of mapping hell. So I suppose my doubts were simply, and now that we've talked for as long as we have, my questions were actually quite unreasonable. It does open, if there was a follow-up question, and that would just be obviously speculation because you don't know, and wouldn't expect you to know. But what the original, the snake in the garden, which I, you know, what was it?
You already asked that at the blog, didn't you?
I might have.
Yeah, is that the original flinch was my answer.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So actually, I was just, my question was really about the lack of efficacy of enlightenment transmissions over epochs. But I have no doubts, and I trust myself sufficiently, especially with the experiences I'm having, to pursue this. As I was talking to a couple of close friends, I could call this off anytime I wanted. It's not like I'm entering a cult with a uniform, going to an ashram, and I have to sell all my belongings.
Yeah, not yet.
So, I just have to uninstall my Zoom.
So that's right. That suggests that people have been skeptical.
No, I was. I think this weekend, the last weekend's Easter event, because don't forget, I've only attended two prior to the Easter event. and I've listened to Dave on your podcast, and essentially, basically, you're my guru. Dave's just you're my Peter or Paul, whatever the context. So I've never really gotten into Dave or his teachings much. I just had two very profound events that I participated in. So after the Easter teachings, I feel less, I'm actually less doubtful. But this question crept up as almost like a logical question. Kind of lent itself to being asked. Why aren't we mass producing gurus and enlightened individuals?
We're mass producing fake gurus and fake awakenings, as far as I can tell. I just spend some time on the internet. My God, you find thousands of people out there claiming to be enlightened and having to have been enlightened by this or that method or teacher. There's this whole movement called Truth Strikes. They claim that they can get enlightened in 48 hours, I believe, just by practicing some technique. And they've got all these people saying, yay, it works, I'm enlightened now, motherfucker. It's like the Fight Club of enlightenment.
Well, the thing is, I would instinctively just delete the page or, you know, play something different. When I first listened to your interview, your podcast with Dave, and the moment he said something about enlightenment, I literally switched the podcast off and I said to myself, I've got a wife and daughter. I have no time for this shit. I have no time for this. I don't have time to be enlightened. I've got bills to pay, things to do. Now, I wouldn't have switched that podcast off. Something resonated in me and I thought, all right, this could actually happen. Now, podcast off, I don't have time for enlightenment. I would have never in any other context responded in the same way, because there's certain truth to what was being offered. I was almost in danger of going in that path. Whereas if something crops up on the internet of someone claiming enlightenment, I just don't want to listen because it's obnoxious.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I had no idea you had that strong reaction. So how long ago was that then?
It would have been, well, actually, I never looked at the archives, but it would have been before the free event. So let's say beginning of last year.
And did you ever listen to that podcast?
I did. That's why I came to the free event.
So you turned it off and then you questioned your decision.
Yeah, I just thought I actually made myself laugh because I've been reading on said topics for 20 odd years. And then the next day I was like, what the hell happened? Why did I switch it off? It's something I'm interested in. And he was coming and he was a guest on your podcast, which meant that you vetted him. So I had every reason to listen to him, even if I was to hear something vaguely interesting or something new.
Yeah.
I had no reason to switch it off, certainly. So yeah, so it was I literally giggled the next day. That was my response. It's like, these were my thoughts. I have a wife and daughter. I don't have time to be enlightened. And then I came back to it at my friend's insistence and I listened to it and I thought, this makes a lot of sense. I really do appreciate it.
So somebody encouraged you to listen to it?
Yeah. I came to your site through a friend, and another friend pointed me in the direction of that particular podcast.
Yeah, but they haven't joined any of the Dave events.
One of them has, but I'll leave that to him. All of us, all of my close friends, are very much aware of the digital footprint, so we don't engage so much. I had Facebook 11 years ago. It turns out I'm a natural voyeur, so I had to delete that after a year. And then I was on Twitter for about a couple of years, I think. And I just couldn't. I preferred checking if anyone had retweeted me over spending time, you know, in the park with my daughter. So I had to delete that.
Right.
But the only reason because I realized how you're going out on a limb with all the material that you're producing. And if I was reading it, I thought it was only fair to put my name to my comments, because I'm not retweeting bullshit, excuse my French. I'm actually engaging someone very personally, so the least I could do is offer my name. But I don't do that. It's not, I'm not on message boards, forums, social networks.
Hmm.
And my close friends are very much alike that.
Well, I know of one of your friends who emailed me and was at the London event and who went to the live event. I think that's the only one of your crew that I've encountered.
Yeah, well, the other friend reads your blog, but he hasn't met Dave. And
does he comment at the blog?
No. But definitely appreciates the work. I mean, we discuss it amongst ourselves occasionally. We all have different phases. My daughter's now grown up; he's got a baby, so we don't have the same rhythm anymore. We've been very, very close in discussing world affairs and exchanging material for a very long time.
Chugging the wine there, Ted.
Well, I know your policy, so I respect it. Maybe one day I'll be able to turn the water into wine. We'll see. So far, it's just water.
Well, maybe we knocked that on the head, and maybe we didn't. I don't know. It was a very interesting conversation, and I felt I was certainly a bit inhibited in certain places because I was going into things I wasn't sure if I should go into. But so I'll be interested to hear it back. But it certainly sparked some exploration. I mean, I think you're you're a good person to testify today because you seem pretty rooted, pretty grounded, pretty skeptical, like the least likely to be susceptible to any kind of, hoodoo guru stagecraft. And your experiences have been themselves also very rooted and grounded and simple and straightforward and so it's certainly helped me. I think I might have said that already to you, to have your feedback and the way that you've been reflecting back what I've been transmitting and then what Dave's been transmitting. It's definitely made me feel more rooted myself. Having a creation warrior by my side, who's really, not got any time for bullshit, is my sense of you.
Oh, Jason, that's a wonderful faux pas because I'm Serb.
Serb, yeah, sorry.
No, but that can go into many another different topic. But I thought that was a beautiful mistake, especially if we're trying to shed our identities or conditions anyway.
Well, I was close, though, right?
Yeah, very close. We were essentially the same people, divided by which religion rules us. That's another story.
The end of my conversation with Chedomir. Next week's podcast, I think I'll be sharing an audio conversation I did with Gnostic Warrior for his podcast, which somehow he hasn't put up and I haven't heard back from him, so something weird's going on there, so I'm just going to share it as a liminalist next week. I'm going to be mounting a campaign to raise funds to publish Maps of Hell, Hollywood secret societies, superculture, and psychological warfare, occupation in the global psyche. That will be at my website, and you can support it by donating to that cause. Anyway, we'll see how that proceeds, but I'm hoping to have the book ready to go sometime in late summer. For those of you who've been waiting and waiting patiently for that one to emerge, from the horticultural pipeline. Alright, I think that's everything for this week. I'm still doing live Zoom meets. There's a guys meet regular. There's an affinity group for people interested in Deva Shana on Wednesday mornings. And the general Limitless meet on an irregular basis. If you want to support the Limitless podcast and the horticulture blog, donate via the PayPal flower in the sidebar at the website.